But you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to innumerable angels in festal gathering, and to the assembly of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and to God the judge of all, and to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks better, a better word than the blood of Abel. And God always blesses the public reading of his inspired and his infallible word.
We are on part 49 of our exploration of the book of Hebrews. I think something should happen next week when it is part 50. Somebody somewhere should celebrate or do something. And I want to focus our attention in today on verse 22. And one phrase in verse 22. You have come to Mount Zion. We looked at that last week. And to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem. That's where I want us to spend all of our time today, trying to get something of an understanding of what that means. There are seasons when everything feels like we're living out of suitcases, emotionally, spiritually, even relationally. We are in temporary mode. Plans shift and people change and structures wobble. Even the ground beneath our feet can feel less like rock and more like sand. And Hebrews was written into exactly that kind of pressure. Some of the believers were tired. Some were tempted to drift. Some were longing to return to the familiar securities of the old covenant patterns and their old way of doing religious and spiritual life, because familiarity often masquerades as safety. And into that moment, the writer of Hebrews tells them that Jesus is better. With all of the unpredictability around them, he's better than the old systems, he's better than the old structures, he's better than the competing loyalties, he's better than the empire, he's better than everything and anyone else. He doesn't just offer them optimism, he offers them reality, a different reality that is so solid that it even redefines what solid means. You have come to the city of the living God. Not you might come or you could come, not you will someday come, but you have come. And if we hear Hebrews properly, it will do something deep in our bones. It will put steel into our spine, fire into our worship, and patience into our struggles and our suffering. Because the Christian life is not primarily about escaping earth. It is about being anchored in heaven's unshakable reality whilst you walk in a shaking world. Verse 22, you have come to Mount Zion, which I looked at last week, the city of the living God, is profoundly important for us to think about, because whoever wrote Hebrews is doing something deliberate. I've told you this before, so I'm not going to dwell on it, but it's important in the context of what we're looking at today. They are describing Sinai, the mountain of trembling and of fear and of darkness and of thunder and of distance. They're not saying it was bad. They're saying it was holy, but Sinai and the experience of Israel was holiness experienced as unapproachable because sin had not yet been finally dealt with in them. Then comes the turning point. You have come, but you have come, but. Somebody last week said to me, have you ever preached on but? And I said, I have preached 17 or 18 messages in a row on the word but let's not do that in the middle of Hebrews. But you have come. Verse 22. The whole passage turns on that one word. It's the shift from one atmosphere to another. It's the shift from distance to access, from fear to assurance, from shadow to substance, from unfulfilled longing to fulfilled approach. Sinai, the mount where Moses received the words from God, reveals holiness and exposes guilt. Zion, as I told you last week, reveals holiness and provides access. And what Hebrews names isn't merely a change of religious mood. It is a change of belonging. It is a change of realm. And that's important. So when the writer says you have come to Mount Zion, he's not asking you to buy a ticket to go to a hill in Jerusalem. He's announcing that through Christ, believers now participate in the heavenly reality here on earth for which the earthly Zion, Jerusalem, has always been a signpost. Now, as we look at the city of the living God, if you are interested in church history or in church theology, Christian theology, then there is one book above all others that I commend to you. It is tough reading. It is at times complicated, but it is the most masterly exposition of the city of God that you will find. And it's called, surprisingly, The City of God by St. Augustine, in which he explores this idea. And he fundamentally asks or proposes that there are two cities that define our existence, an earthly city or a heavenly city. And if we are followers of Jesus, we are defined by the heavenly city. And if we are not, we are defined by the earthly city. And he probes this deeply by asking, which city do you belong to? Which city has your heart? Which city has your motivation? Which city captures your imagination? Now, I'm not going to read all of City of God. It is a deep text, but there are a few quotes here and there across today that I'm going to use to hopefully whet your appetite a little bit. The earthly city, he says, seeks an earthly peace. The heavenly city, which sojourns on earth and lives by faith, makes use of this peace only because it must, until this mortal condition shall pass away. Now you might say, that's not that exciting. You're not convincing me to read the book. What Augustine is saying is you can have a temporary peace or a permanent one. And depending on the city that you set your hope on, that will dictate the peace that you experience. A temporary peace that is changed by circumstances and events and the surrounding context of your life, or a permanent peace that is held no matter what the context, the circumstances, or the events of your life might look like. And when the writer says, you have come, I told you last week, again, just to help you remember, that this is not just a verb written down, it's a statement of assurance, settled arrival. You came and you remain in that arrived state. Wherever you are today, you have come to Mount Zion, the city of the living God. Hebrews and its writer is saying your relationship with God is not a perpetual almost. It is a perpetual intimacy. You have come. You remain in that position. Not nearly there, not maybe accepted, not occasionally admitted. In Jesus Christ, your admittance is complete and your approach is accomplished. That is consistent with the whole of the book of Hebrews. In chapter 4, verse 14, the writer says, Jesus is the great high priest who has passed through the heavens. In chapter 4, verse 16, because of that, the writer says, let us therefore approach the throne of grace with boldness. In chapter 10, verse 19, The writer says, Jesus is the mediator whose sacrifice is complete. Therefore, we have confidence to enter the sanctuary. And in chapter 12, verse 22, the same idea articulated again. You have come to the city of the living God. It's not triumphalism. It is gospel truth. And this is when my spirituality as a Pentecostal scholar is important. This is biblically deeply important. The Spirit keeps me in this place. He gives me expectation because this is my citizenship. I belong in this community. I am part of this living city. No one can take me out of it. The Spirit doesn't merely comfort the uncertain. The Spirit witnesses that the access to God is real. Right now, whatever you're facing, remember who Hebrews was written to. Hebrews speaks about believers tasting the powers of the age to come. In Hebrews chapter 6, verse 5, tasting. It's a sensory word. It's an immediate word. It's a moment. Right now, I can taste the presence of God and the purpose and the mercy of Jesus, particularly in worship and in prayer and when we break bread, when we live in obedience, when we follow the mission of God, when we allow the Spirit to shape us. We are part of this and it is part of us. Augustine again. Accordingly, two cities have been formed by two loves. The earthly by the love of self, even to the contempt of God, and the heavenly by the love of God, even to the contempt of self. Why does the Bible, why does the writer of Hebrews give this city an urban definition? Rather than this garden, which is where the Bible ends, when the whole of the world becomes a garden city. The city is an important idea. This is the only place in the Bible, by the way. Hebrews 12, 22 is the only place in the Bible where the exact phrase, the city of the living God, is found. It is nowhere else. It's what's called a hapax legomenon. That's a Greek word, two Greek words. Hapax means once and legomenon means written. So it's only here, nowhere else in 1,285 chapters of the Bible do you find this phrase. You find phrases that are close to it, but not this phrase. There are some Old Testament parallels. Psalm 46, verses 4 and 5, there is a river whose streams make glad the city of God. Psalm 48, verses 1 to 3, in one of my most favorite choruses, is taken from this verse. He is great as the Lord in the city of our God. Psalm 87, verse 3, glorious things are spoken of you, O city of God. These passages help us understand what the writer of Hebrews is thinking about when he says the city of the living God, but they're not the same phrase. And then in different parts of the Old Testament, there's a different phrase, the city of the Lord, not the city of our God or the city of God, but the city of the Lord. In Isaiah chapter 60, verse 14, they will call you the city of the Lord, Zion, of the Holy One of Israel. And then right at the end of the Bible, in Revelation 21, verse 2, as John is describing how everything ends, we read this, I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem coming down out of heaven from God. And that's when the world becomes a garden city. Hebrews repeatedly reframes or gives us the sense that our journey with God or our pilgrimage is toward a God-prepared city. Well, why not a garden? Why not a lake? Why not the mountain? Because they're all biblical phrases. And some of them appear in different parts of Hebrews 12. I think the writer of Hebrews chooses the word city because biblically a city is a social and a governed and an enduring reality. A city is a symbol of belonging. It's a people, not just a place, like the cities of refuge. A city speaks of identity, citizenship. I belong here. There's a wall that will protect me here. There are ramparts. There are gates that are open. The enemy cannot get in. The attacker cannot overcome the wall. I'm in the city. It's not just a spiritual idea. There is an order in a city, a rule, not randomness. There are principles to live by. And there's continuity. It has foundations. It is not tense. It doesn't arrive today and move tomorrow. It stays. And a city has a culture. It has a way of doing things. All of those tell me that there is a city that I am safe in. There is a wall that surrounds me. There is a culture that shapes me. There is a protector that will hold me. There is a gate that will keep me safe. And there's a welcome committee ready for me. And Hebrews has already prepared us for this idea. In chapter 11, verse 10, I mentioned it to you last week if you were here, talks about Abraham and says he looked forward to the city that has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. And then in verse 16 of the same chapter, chapter 11, the writer of Hebrews says that those that were traveling, those pilgrims of faith, desire a better country, that is a heavenly one. And then later, not in this chapter, but in chapter 13, the writer of Hebrews in verse 14 tells everyone as he draws his thoughts to a close, for here we have no lasting city, but we are looking for the city that is to come. I love that. Here, there is no lasting city. This amazing metropolis that we call London, this global city, is nothing compared to the city that I belong to. It is has no power, no strength, no significance, no light, no beauty compared to the city that I belong to as a child of God. So Hebrews is not randomly asking you to think about city language. It's a thread that is tied through the whole letter. The people of faith live as pilgrims precisely because we belong to a different civic reality, a city that is built by God. Now, let me use a metaphor in the hope that it will help you. And it is the metaphor of an embassy. Think of the embassies just down, where is, just down the road. I don't know, I'm not very good at geography. Down there, is it over there somewhere? There's a whole, if you know this bit of London, there's a whole street of embassies. I love walking past them and pretending I live in them. I must try to knock one of the doors one day to see if they'll let me in. What do you think? Do you think that would work? There's particularly a Russian one there that I think it might be problematic, but anyway. Think of an embassy. It sits geographically in one nation, but it is legally and politically representative of another. The language changes when you go into the embassy. The authority changes. The culture changes. Now, it's only as I've thought about this message for this week in the last couple of weeks that I've thought about this. I've often thought of the church as an embassy. Often, it's part of my theological exploration. But always in a kind of highest point of reference way. And as I have prepared for today, I thought, well, at best we are an embassy. Pointing to the city. At best we are, you know, for me, embassy language has always been language of elevation. Do you understand what I mean? Language of, this is what I belong to, oh, yeah, the rules apply here differently. That's all true, and it is strong and beautiful and powerful, but at best, I'm an embassy. Who wants to live in an embassy when they want to get home? You go to the embassy to get your permit to go home. You go to the embassy when you have an issue so that home will protect you, right? The only people that live in the embassy are the people that actually are there to represent home. And I think sometimes we can behave as if we're more than an embassy, but we're just an embassy. But we're an embassy of a city that will never, ever die. We are located on earth, but we represent another city. We represent another kingdom. We represent another government. So when Hebrews says you have come to the city, it's calling you to live as someone whose ultimate belonging is already established. That doesn't mean that we are dislocated from earth. We will spend eternity on a new earth. But it means that the values and the priorities of heaven shape the way we live now. Some time ago, I was writing a book about the new heavens and the new earth, or chapter four, a book about the new heavens and the new earth. And I came across a quote that, I don't know if this has ever happened to you when you're doing any research or working. I remembered it, but I couldn't remember where it was. So I spent 3 days the week before last looking for this quote. Could I remember where it was? Because it's pertinent to what I'm going to say to you now. And I really wanted to include it in my message. I was like, Lord, I can't remember it. And you not believe me, but it is true. Last night I had a dream about that quote. And I remembered the quote word for word in my dream. So I got up this morning and I typed it in and I found it. And I'm so excited. It doesn't even make any difference to you, but it was very exciting to me. It's from a book called Through New Eyes, Developing a Biblical View of the World, published in 1988 and written by J.B. Jordan. If you're interested, it's on pages 42 and 47. Listen to the quote. Man is to labor. Listen to this. Man is to labor to take the raw materials of the earth and remodel it according to the heavenly blueprint. Heaven forms the model for earth, not the other way around, socially, morally, spiritually, and in every other way. Listen again. If it took me this long to find it, I'm going to read it twice. Man is to labor to take the raw materials of the earth and remodel it according to the heavenly blueprint. Heaven forms the model for earth, socially, morally, spiritually, and in every other way. Your relationships, your money, your time, your home, my money, my time, my relationships, my home, your calendar, my calendar, the way you behave, it's all earthly stuff. God gives it to us, and we are to remodel it according to the city of the living God. Of the living God. That's the bit that makes this phrase completely different to anything else in the Bible. The city is alive because God is alive. It's not the first city of the redeemed. It's not the first city of the angels. It's not the first city of worship. It is the city of God. And not just God as an idea, the living God. You have come to the city of the living God. That's not sentimentality. Hebrews uses living God in ways that carry both comfort and warning in other parts of its letter. Chapter 3, verse 12. Take care that none of you may have an evil, unbelieving heart that turns away from the living God. Chapter 9, verse 14. Christ offered himself without blemish to God to worship the living God. First a warning, the second an act of worship. Chapter 10, verse 31. It is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. This time judgment and holiness. So living God means God is present, God is active, God is engaged, God is holy. He is not passive. He's not an idea. He is a God who speaks, he judges, he saves, he sanctifies, he shakes. The city of the living God is saying this city is not a museum of religious memory. It's not a monument to a past revival. It's not an archive of spiritual experiences. It is the dwelling place of the God who is, who revealed himself as the ever-living one. And therefore, our stability, the stability of the city, comes from the living God. It comes from God's life. Earthly life, earthly cities can be glorious but still very fragile. They can be wealthy but still very corrupt. They can be ancient and still fall down. But this city's performance is rooted in its permanence. It is not built or engineered by human hands. It is rooted in God's own dwelling, his own being, his existence. God doesn't merely own the city, he animates it. He doesn't visit it, he lives in it. He doesn't inaugurate it, he sustains it. If God is living, then what belongs to him cannot be dead. A.W. Tozer, the famous American revivalist and pastor, said, "What comes into our minds when we think about God is the most important thing about us." That's why systematic theology always begins with a description of who God is. Because we can't understand who we are until we understand God, something of God's existence. Tozer's point isn't academic. If you think of God as distant, you will live as though access is uncertain. If you think of God as living near and in Christ, you will live as a citizen and not as a beggar. Mount Zion, the city of the living God. As I explored last week, Mount Zion comes from the Old Testament pictures of Zion, royal Zion, where the king reigned in Psalm 2. Covenantal Zion, where God's dwelling place is present. Worshipping Zion, where the temple was. Eschatological Zion, which is a space of hope and comfort. So Mount Zion, the city of the living God, reminds us of God's nearness and his power. And then the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem. Now, I'm not going to comment too much on that today, other than to say this. It points to two truths that we have to hold together. The first is, already, you have come. Present access, present participation, and assurance. But the second thing is, not yet. The city will be fully unveiled in the future consummation when Jesus returns. And that's a standard biblical New Testament idea. We live between inauguration and completion. Between Christ has come and Christ will come again. And Pentecostal theology, when healthy, refuses to be on one side of that. And if we get out of whack, we end up on the wrong side of one of those. We are not all future, as though nothing can be tasted now. That's why I'm a Pentecostal. But we are not all now. It's why we go through pain. It's why words that offer people hope that pretend that what they're going through isn't real are useless and dangerous. We believe in the already and the not yet. It's all ours. And even when our lives on earth end, we still win. Nothing can take that away. And Hebrews has earlier called us to run with endurance the race set before us. And this chapter, not because the finish line is in question, but because the finish line is certain. Don't slow down. You may not see the finish line around the bend, but don't believe the bend is the end of the game. The Spirit is the down payment. Zion is home, so keep running. I was trying to think of an image or a metaphor or an illustration that might help you with this. And it took me a while, but I came up with one. My wife and I have moved 21 times or something in 33 years of married life. It's too many. And we have bought a few houses along the way. And when you buy a house, there is a moment when the deed is legally yours, but you don't have the keys yet. And moving day is still ahead. Ownership is settled. Your mortgage payments prove it. But in my analogy, you've paid cash. There is no mortgage. Ownership is settled, but occupation is unfolding. You haven't moved in yet. The house isn't going to move to you. You're going to move to the house, but it's yours. You're just not in it yet. Hebrews is saying in Christ, ownership is settled. You have the deeds. There's a space here for you. And the Spirit gives you the foretaste of the occupation. But the moving in day, the final unveiling day, well, that will be glorious. So what does it mean practically that we belong to the city of the living God? First of all, it means that your identity is always civic before it is cultural. Let me explain what I mean, because I understand that's a complicated phrase. London will try to name you. Your birth country, if it isn't the UK, will try to name you. Your history will try to define you. Your past will try to brand you. And your failures will try to imprison you. But the gospel says, before any of that, you are a citizen of the city of the living God. My most decisive label is not my curriculum vitae, my CV, or if you're an American, my resume. My most decisive label, are you laughing at me, Claudette? Is not my reputation. It is not my trauma. It is not my upbringing. It is not the pressures that I am facing right now. The thing that defines me most, the label that never removes, is I am in Christ and Christ is in me, and I belong to the city of the living God. And belonging changes my behavior. Citizens act differently from strangers. I know that. I was in Paris over the weekend. The people that live in Paris are very relaxed about Paris. People like me who do not live in Paris get lost. It also means that we are governed by a different king. A city implies government. Zion has a throne. And the heavenly Jerusalem implies rule. We are not ultimately governed by outrage cycles and fear cycles and consumption cycles. We are defined under the reign of Jesus. So if that's true, then what does Zion, the heavenly Jerusalem, the city of the living God, what government, what actions does such government produce in my life as a believer? Integrity when dishonesty is normal. Generosity when greed is praised. Self-giving when selfishness is held above everything else. Forgiveness when vengeance is fashionable. Holiness when compromise is easier. And courage when fear is contagious. Why? Because I belong to a different city. I don't know if any of you have ever been to Kigali. Anybody ever been to Kigali? It's in Rwanda, the capital of Rwanda. Cleanest city I've ever seen. Absolutely spotless. Because they have a high pride in their cleanliness and an even higher fine if you drop litter. Singapore. Anybody been to Singapore? Singapore is an incredibly clean city. Anybody been to Berlin? Covered in graffiti. There's a cultural thing about graffiti in Berlin. London has its own cultural norms. This city that we belong to has cultural norms. And they are norms of integrity, generosity, forgiveness, holiness, courage. For staff members, our six virtues, that's the culture of the city. I'll not ask you to shout them to me. And if you belong to the city of the living God, but you live like you belong to Babylon, something's gone wrong. It also means not only that our identity is clear and our government is different, but our worship is not an accessory. It is our native language. If the city is of the living God, the most appropriate response is not more discussion about how to worship. For heaven's sake, that's just worship. It is not worship as a mood management, not worship to make you feel better, or worship to give you a smile. Our worship is alignment. It's putting ourselves back onto the reality of that which is most real. We are reminded that worship is not only telling the truth, it is responding to the truth. It's not only singing the truth, it's living the truth with the whole person, mind, body, and spirit. And when this idea, you have come to the city of the living God, captures a church, worship becomes Christ-exalting, Scripture-saturated, Spirit-empowered, reverent and joyful, transformative and not performative. Caught in Augustine's phrase in a different book called Confessions, we are restless everywhere else. You have made us for yourself. And our hearts are restless until they rest in you. When you're having a hard time, what's the thing that you need to do most? I'm not asking you to tell me, it's a rhetorical question. When I'm in a tough spot, when I'm in a hard place, do you know the thing I need to do above everything else? Worship. Because it realigns my perspective. It reorders me. I remember 2 days after my nephew died in 2014, in a traumatic death, the thing I needed to do more than anything else was get and be with God's people. And often when we are mourning, we withdraw from worship. Nothing hinders worship. Nothing hinders worship. My suffering doesn't hinder worship. Death does not hinder worship. Disappointment does not hinder worship. And when you hit a hard patch, the devil says, you don't realize it's the devil. Withdraw. That's the last thing you should do. When you hit a hard patch, the best thing you can do is get into God's presence. You rest in God's presence. You weep in God's presence. You rejoice in God's presence. You dance. You lie down. I don't mean tell lies. You lie down in God's presence. When you are in the presence of God, and I tell you, I have lost count of the number of times that I have been brokenhearted about something and I have not told anyone and I've just come and stood in the presence of God with the people of God. And a little old woman singing out of key here and a little man singing out of key here and an unusual Frenchman blowing a horn changes my spirit. It draws me back into alignment. It reminds me that what I am feeling and experiencing are not my home. I'm not going to camp in those. I'm going to camp in the presence of God. I'm going to stand in the presence of God. And I am going to discipline my body to pay attention to God through worship and to honor Him. That isn't me being lazy. That is me practicing my belonging. That is me declaring I have a different city. And my city is not called suffering. My city is not called pain. My city is not called despair. My city is not called abandonment. My city is not called unloved. My city is not called death. My city is called life. I belong to the city of the living God. Rest is what happens when the soul finds its true city. And one of the greatest dangers for long-term believers is not atheism, I'm going to use a technical phrase, which I will explain to you. The greatest danger to your life is not atheism. And it's not fundamentalist Islamic theology. It is not wealth. It's not suffering. The greatest danger to your spiritual life is functional deism. What? Let me explain. Functional deism lives as if God exists, but is not involved. Believes that God is, but that he's not here. Looks at the world knowing that God is real, but believing that he is distant. When that happens, you've got religion. Hebrews refuses that downgrade. It says the city is of the living God. Is our Christian faith alive with God or merely organized around God? Is your life alive with God or is it organized around God? There's a world of difference. If it's organized around God, you might never miss a meeting. But it is, if it's alive with God, you will never want to miss a moment. Because you realize where your life comes from. Because you can do Christian activity without living God reality, this is dangerous. You can have vocabulary without vitality. I was in a meeting recently where the worship and presence of God was palpable. And when I looked around, at least 100 people around me were on their mobile phones, which is one thing. Maybe they were reading their Bibles on their mobile phones, like, or taking notes like you do, Claudette. This isn't what was happening. They had their hands, one hand, literally one hand up in worship, and the other hand. Have you ever been in meetings like that? I was in a meeting not so long ago where the power of the Lord was really moving, and there was a fella in front of me, and he was like, "You all right? How are you doing? Great to see you." Blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, "That, whatever you're doing, this is not worship. Putting your hand up is not worship." Do you understand what I mean? He was completely engaged in dialogue and discussion with his mates around him and missing completely the presence of God. And he was okay with it. That's not the way we're supposed to live. It's one of the reasons why when I come here and our service begins, I am here to worship him. I know that there are things that we have to do, but we should pay attention to him. We should give him our time and the best of our thinking. You can have form without fire. You can have theology without trembling. You can have church without Zion. But the city of the living God is not entered by tradition alone. It is entered by Christ, and it is lived by the Holy Spirit. And we must defend this. We do not pursue experience for its own sake. We pursue the living God, and experience follows as his mercy flows. I tried to get a photograph to show you, but I wasn't able to do it. Imagine for a moment, we have a house in Ireland and it has a fireplace. It's a lovely fireplace. Well, it's not actually that lovely. It's a really old 1970s fireplace. But it sits in our living room like the prize fireplace that it is. We love our fireplace because we love an open fire. But imagine me bringing you to our house and saying, look at that fireplace. Isn't that fireplace amazing? It's not amazing, by the way. And you say, it's quite cold in here. Yeah, but look at the fireplace. Well, yeah, but there's no fire in it. Yeah, but look at the fireplace. I mean, we got a fireplace. It wasn't built to be a fireplace. It was built to be a place for fire. What point is a fireplace without a fire? What point is a group of believers without the living presence of God? A fireplace can be beautiful, but even when it's cold, it can have a polished mantle, it can have a tidy hearth, it can have arranged logs right beside it. Ours often does. But if there's no fire, the room is still freezing. In fact, we had a friend come from California to our house in Ireland to use it. She came here, Christy Wimber. When next time she comes, ask her how to light a fire. She went to stay in our house for a week and she rang after 3 days and she said, I'm cold. We said, there's heating, turn the heating on. She said, yeah, but there's a fireplace. I said, yes. She said, how do you light a fire? I said, it's all set. All you have to do is light the match and put it under the paper. She couldn't light the fire. She said, I've never lit a fire in my life. I don't know how to light a fire. So the fireplace promised heat but delivered nothing because there was no fire in it. And if there's no fire, the room is freezing. Some believers have a well-arranged hearth. Great theology. Brilliant habits. Amazing church attendance. But no fire. And God is calling the church to fire. Not to hype, not to manipulation, but the living presence of God. The logs were never the point. The fire was the point. I quite like this analogy, by the way. The form is not ultimate. The living God is ultimate. Let me give you another picture. I take you and your wife, Scott, to Paris. I say, I'm going to take you to Paris for a weekend. I've got a lovely museum I want to take you to. And I take you to the Louvre and I take you up to where the Mona Lisa is. And it's not a very big painting. And I said, look at that. Look at that. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing? Look at that. Look at that. And you say, it's amazing. And I say, it's breathtaking, isn't it? And you and Irina are like, it's amazing. And I say, have you ever seen a photo, a painting frame like that in your life? And you say, what are you looking at? And I say, I brought you to look at the frame. Look at the frame around this painting. And you're like, it's not the frame that's priceless. It's the painting. And I say, but yeah, the painting's not all that. She doesn't even have eyebrows. I'm valuing the wrong thing. I'm prizing the wrong thing. Look at the screen. Oh, amazing, isn't it? It's just a screen. An expensive screen. But it's just a screen. All it is there for is to help us connect with God. I've been to people who said, look at our building. I went, amazing, but it's just a building. I'm not here to see the building, I'm here to see God. Look at our staff team, isn't it amazing? Look, we have 10,000 staff, aren't we amazing? I'm like, yeah, but the staff is only a means to an end. Look at my gifts. What do you think of my preaching? Don't answer. What do you think of my preaching? None of them are the point. None of them are the point. The fire of God, the life of God, the hope of God, the presence of God, the living God is our point. When Hebrews says, you have come to the city of the living God, it's doing two things at once. It is confronting our counterfeit security. The original listeners were under pressure and tempted to retreat to what looked like stable and reliable ways of doing life. But Hebrews says your stability is not what is in the familiar, it is in what is final. That confronts every ear as idle. Money isn't your security. Status isn't your security. Control isn't your security. Human approval isn't security. Religion's performance isn't your security. The living God is our only security. That's why Hebrews finishes with, since you are receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken. Peter did this after Jesus' resurrection. I'm going fishing. Anyone coming with me? Didn't work, fellas. What was the point? I can make a living through fishing. My family are back where I caught fish. My neighbors are there. Security is there. There's a roof over my head. There's food to put in my kids' bellies or my belly. There's a life that I'm familiar with and is comfortable. All I have to give away is my dream. All I have to give away is the potential of what God could do with me. I'm going fishing. When you think, I'll just go back to my old life. Pastoring is too hard. Leading is too hard. Preaching is too hard. Singing is too hard. Worshiping is too hard. Serving is too hard. You're replacing what is inexplicable with what is comfortable and safe. And this message says, don't do that. But it also comforts. You're not on your own. You might feel far from home. You might not be able to see the city. You might not know the finish line. You might feel as if you are in a wilderness. But you are not stranded. You are not abandoned. You are not merely surviving until heaven. You won't come to that city in the end. You're in that city now. You just can't see it. Its walls surround you. Its ramparts guard you. Its king protects you. Its culture shapes you and forms you. Yes, you're in pain. But your pain is reframed when you realize, I am a citizen of the city of the living God. Suffering is not your story. It is a chapter in your story. It is not the final paragraph. Shaking is not the verdict on your life. It is a process you are going through, and it will end. Weakness is no longer the place where you are defeated. It is the place where the city of the living God and its power can be displayed. I pray that you will be encouraged. We have focused on verse 22, one phrase, the city of the living God. But in the wider context of verses 22 to 24 that Toby read, Christ is kept central. Zion is not an abstract postcode. It is the reality of living for Jesus and with Jesus. You come to the city because Jesus is the mediator of a better covenant. That's what verse 24 says. You come to the city because Jesus is enthroned there. You come to the living God because Jesus has opened the way. So the call of Hebrews is never try to imagine the living city. It is draw near through Christ to who you really are. And the Spirit's work is to make the nearness something that is not just theatrical. It is here. He is right here, right where he will always be. He will never abandon you. If he does, he's a liar. Never will I leave you. Never will I forsake you. I can't see you. Scott, who's behind you? Don't turn around. How many people are in this room? If you miss one, they're not here. Just because you can't see them doesn't mean they're not there. Who's behind you? Who's behind you? Who's behind you? Who's behind you? We so often allow silly principles to shape our spirituality. Just because you can't see God doesn't mean he's not there. He's always there. There'll never be a moment in our lives when he is not there. Even when we don't feel him, he is there. And he draws us into glorious life and into deep and profound hope. C.S. Lewis in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe talked about Aslan. And Lucy, the little girl who had met him, was asked, what's he like? What is this great lion that is the representative of God like? What's he like? Is he safe? And she said, safe? Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe, but he is good. God is good. The living God is here. He is not manageable. He is not tame. He is good. And his city is our home.